Dennis, I've been going through all these archives from the Studio B recordings, and I noticed they don't go back all the way to the very beginning of the station, because in the beginning, there was no Studio B, and I'm thinking very little taping and maybe very little live guests. What do you know about the very beginning of that here at WNCW?
Well, the word crowd around the mic comes from the fact that it was actually done in the air studio. We call it the Charles Benedict Memorial Air Studio now. But there were recording devices in there, recorded to DATs, D-A-T's, and that was how that started. Actually, Studio B was there. It was just full of broken chairs and books and anything else that wasn't used on campus. That was the place that they thought, oh, we know where there's a big room that's not being used, and they piled it all in there. And so every time we had to have a fundraiser, we'd have to go in and clean all that stuff out in order to even just be able to set up for a fundraiser. So it was probably there a couple of times during there. You know, I came here in 93, and a couple of times during that period along there, 93, 94, we would actually clean it out when we knew there was going to be a relatively big artist coming in that needed room, and we'd want the full band sound in it. But it was about 95 or so when the decision was finally made, okay, this is really a studio, and this is what this was meant to do. And that was when we no longer used it for broken chairs and desks and books, and we started actually putting the studio together. It was still very primitive equipment at the time, you know, lots of just, you know, they were still decent microphones. And, you know, it was really an old mixer that was in there, but nowhere near the kind of quality we had. But about 95 or so is when they started earmarking funds, actually making spaces in the budget to buy equipment to do the studio right, so that we could do, actually wouldn't be, you know, telling people to come and perform live when we really didn't have the equipment to do so. But those early ones, there are some around, but I don't know what happened to those tapes. I don't know where they went. Do you know where the oldest ones that you have goes back to?
The oldest one I have found is from 1994. With Adrian Legg. It's absolutely delightful, and it's an interview with Greg Hills, who was the first program director at WNCW. Definitely one in my pocket to air on the show, but that's the earliest one by far that I have found.
And that was recorded live at a fundraiser.
You're absolutely right.
Sitting around the pitch table, I remember doing it just as like it was yesterday.
Yeah, because Wanda Lou pipes in with a question, I think, or a comment, and I think I hear Vicki Morgan, she was then, Vicki mm-hmm. Dameron now, a few other voices that I don't recognize. But yeah, it was very much kind of a community thing during the funder.
That was the year that we stopped allowing the chairs, broken desk, and things to go back in.
Well, let me ask you this. When did you come on the scene, and how did you become the Studio B engineer?
Well, it was 93. You know, I came here in 93, the fall of the year. I actually had moved back home in the early part of the year. And a buddy of mine he said, well, what are you doing next Saturday? And I said, well, you know, I'll be taking out the trash and running some errands and stuff. He's like, well, go with me to answer phones for the public radio station. They're doing a fundraiser. And I'm like, sure, I'll be glad to do it. And I came up, and they had an old-time band scheduled, and I can't remember their names. I don't know who they were. But anyway, there was supposed to have been an engineer here, a volunteer engineer was going to be here, and he hadn't shown up. And, you know, I could see people talking and murmuring amongst themselves over there, and it was Burbeard was station manager at the time, and I remember saying, well, I don't guess we'll be able to put him on. We don't have an engineer. And I told him, I said, you're not going to believe this, but I'm an engineer. And he said, I don't care if you drive a train, give it a shot. And so, you know, I set him up, and we did it, and we went from there. The next thing I knew, they had actually set me down at the pitch table. This was back when it was 14-day fundraisers.
Oh, I remember as a listener.
Starting at 6 o'clock in the morning and going to about 11 or midnight.
Bitter end 30, I think.
Right. And that was all day long. For 2 weeks it went like that. So I came back and they sat me down. They actually put me at the table pitching. It was in the days when we read underwriters from cards. They were typed out on cards. We didn't have any such thing as virtual traffic like we have now, or, you know, any of the modern programs that we use now. Someone was actually hand typing these things, and they were typewriters. It wasn't on a computer. And so I'm sitting talking, and they're asking me about music, and they would hand me one of those cards to read. And I was just, you know, I just read the card and put it down and move on. And so eventually through like that, that's where I became really involved with it. And, you know, and then hanging out with Russ Jordan, who was doing going across the mountain at the time I was here. And then, you know, we would do live acts on Saturdays. And they were like, well, hey, we need to be doing that during the week also. Well, we still didn't have quite the equipment to do it down there. So some of the sessions, even up until 95 or 96, were
98.
Still, 98 were still done in the Air studio. And we had a little tiny mixer that I would bring in and put maybe four or five microphones. So it was no longer a crowd around the mic. There were actually more microphones than one, but it was all recorded down to a stereo mix that I had two inputs that I could put up on the old board. And, oh, wow, that was that old board, it was a nightmare. It was in the Air studio. It had those film type connectors where you had to turn them off and on, and you never knew whether they were really off or on or anything, but it was very interesting. And the quality that we got in the Air studio really is a great testament to the fact of the quality of the musicians that came in and performed. You know, there were no monitors. Oftentimes they didn't wear headphones, no headphones or anything, but yet they were still listening to each other. And really some great recordings came out of the Air studio at the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've heard that through some of the tapes that I've been through in preparing for the show, Studio B Rewind. And having been here as a newbie, starting in about 96, I remember some of those really early sessions in the Air studio. And there were some really big bands that got crammed in there. And I was going to ask you if you remember, like, the biggest band. But I remember in particular a reggae band that was in there. And they had a full drum kit in there with you and the DJ and the other members of the band.
Right. We had the drums out in the hallway. Put that drum out. And I can't remember their names either, but I can see them now. Oh, and I want to say they were from New York, but I can remember that. But that's right. Yeah, it was probably about the biggest group. And then, you know, several different bluegrass acts that would have five or six members that would be in, that would be working. You know, you would see that would be a large number of folks. John Cowan, he brought a large group of folks in one time, a really big band that, you know, they sat around and, you know, more or less just a stripped down version of what they do. They did that, but yeah, we got some great recordings out of there. We did pretty good for what we had. It was, you know, rocks and sticks. It was good recording.
I remember seeing a few, you know, flints and, yeah, and sparks, right, and things. You told me one time that the acoustics in Studio B were perfect, and it's kind of accidental. What did you mean by that?
Well, what happened is, you know, the building was started early 88, and, you know, by the time they had got around to finishing it, you know, it was actually designed, a gentleman named Andy Abdul is the gentleman who designed all these studios and who put them all in there. And if you are in Studio B and you pull the drapes back, the theatrical drapes that are in there, if you pull them back, you'll notice that the walls are not straight. They are curved. So that's one of the reasons it helps with reflections and all. And then we have those massive studio drapes. And then everybody always wants to know about, well, why are all those cardboard boxes laid up there? Can we not move the cardboard boxes? And I'm like, no. Well, can we not straighten them up? And I'm like, no, you can't move the cardboard boxes, because that's part of what happens. You know, we could spend thousands and thousands of dollars to replicate what the cardboard boxes are doing. But the cardboard boxes work just fine. But it is. It's part accident, but also it comes from part design from Andy. You know, he really had a great grasp of what was going on studio-wise. The one thing that's really interesting about the studio is no matter where you're standing in the studio, whether it be at the farthest corner or you're standing right next to each other, you speak at the same volume, you're able to hear yourself because the acoustics are so great in the room.
I did not realize that about those cardboard boxes, because I remember when I was here full time, I used to always think, why don't we get those cardboard boxes down?
Well, originally the room was designed to have no square corners, and that was going to be all rolled in so that it would fit neatly with the air conditioning ducts, and everything would all come in and there would be no square corners. But state contract, they ran out of money and they wound up having to do those squared off tops and things the way they did. You know, the air conditioning vents are not sealed in like they were designed to be. They're just out in the open. So, you know, when I was here, I was like, well, you know, that's going to create a problem. There's going to be standing waves there. And there were a bunch of cardboard boxes. So I just had to randomly stack them up there. And if you'll look at any studio, any world-class studio, you're going to see what we're talking about. They're little wood blocks a lot of times, and there'll be longer ones and shorter ones. There'll be fatter ones and skinnier ones, and it's all designed to break up the standing waves, and that's what happens with it. But yeah, that's something the musicians always, one of the first things they'll say about the studio when they come in, if they've never been here before, is they go, man, it's a great sounding room. And like I say, it is pretty good. It's a good one. Well, of course, you know, 18-foot ceiling doesn't hurt.
That's right. Well, speaking of the musicians, there's been such a variety of musicians that have come through there, from Vieux Farquhar-Touré to Janis Ian, Jimmy Thackeray, Michael Reno Harrell, the Nashville Bluegrass Band, just a wide variety of music. And this, I know I'm putting you on the spot, but what would you say they all have in common?
Oh, my. Oh.
From your point of view.
When you're looking at that caliber, at that level of touring musicians, they all are the very definition of the word professional. You know, they are easily and readily adaptable pretty much to any situation, you know, whether it would be, you know, a horrible stage sound, you know, they're going to overcome it and do the performance for that evening. And those folks all possess that same thing. They all have that same ability to come in and see, you know, and then once they come in, you know, they're comfortable. You know, that's something that people don't really know what I do. They hear the music when it goes out over the air, but they don't know about the pre-production work that goes in. You know, I start in sometimes maybe a month out contacting with management, and then eventually it goes from management through to a technical person that may be road manager slash technician, sound person, or whatever they got on the road with them. And then if those people can't eventually answer questions that I have, then I speak to the artists themselves. So I do that bit of pre-production work. And then when they get here, you know, we have them arrive an hour early just so that we get them in, we get them comfortable, get everybody relaxed, get them all sit down, get them tuned up. And the main thing you do is you start talking to them and you get their mind off of, it's going to be a radio interview, and we put the focus on it's going to be a performance. You try to remove that thought from their mind that, oh no, I've got to be talked to and I've got to sound intelligent, when all you really do is come in, sit down, and talk to them about their music. They're not worried about being interviewed. They're all of a sudden comfortable. They played a great song, and now they won't talk about it.
Very, very interesting. And you leapt right ahead to a question I had, is because when folks are listening to the station, the first thing they know, they hear us saying that so-and-so is going to be in Studio B. Then they hear Roland or Martin or Scotty or Joe come on and say, or you, if it's on Saturday, if it's a bluegrass act, say, we're in Studio B with, you know, the XYZ band. And there is so much that goes on before that. So I guess I would just say you answered that question in advance. Yeah.
Oops.
And this is one you've touched on as well, and we'll let you go into the gear porn area for just a minute.
All right.
How has the gear changed down there?
Oh, my. It's drastic. I mean, you know, it went from, from equipment that was from late 60s, early 70s. And I'm not talking about like truly vintage gear. It was just old equipment that was down there, to where we now are truly a state-of-the-art facility. I mean, you know, we have, you know, there's boutique preamps, there's custom-made microphones. Everything that we have in the studio is like you would find anywhere in Nashville, Los Angeles, New York City. I mean, it rivals any studio as far as gear goes. And one of the things that, you know, we're able to do is, you know, we always record a safety mix of what goes out over the air live, but everything's also multi-tracked out. You know, all the instruments are multi-tracked out. And that's how I make Crowd Around the Mic now. You know, the tracks that we use for Crowd Around the Mic, you know, I'm able to go back in, because a lot of times, especially in the early days when we were doing it on tape, you know, it never would fail that the song that we wanted, someone would start playing it, and right before they would start singing it, they would clear their throat. Well, there's no way to fix that. You know, I mean, that was on the tape. You couldn't, we couldn't use it. We'd have to pick another song. Now I have the ability to go back in and cut those sounds out, take all the squeaks and the leather guitar straps away. Sometimes you can't do all of them because it is live music and it is, you know, in the room, so there is some bleed through. But that's one of the great things that's happened about it, is we have the ability now to track out. We're able to do seven separate headphone mixes. So there are seven mixes in the room, which most bands only ask for four mixes if they're on stage, maybe five. We do seven, and they're all individual headphone mixes. So everybody gets to hear what they want to hear. And, that's something that you always hear. They're like, well, man, I wish we could hear like this on stage every night. Or one of my favorite quotes that I hear all the time is we'll be doing a sound check and they'll be playing some songs and you'll see somebody look over at somebody and they'll say, is that the part you sing every night? And you just go, oh, I hope I haven't really caused a big problem here. Is that the part you play every night? Because they're on a loud stage. And down there you hear everything that's happening. You just hear it. But that's the biggest thing is being able to have the space. It's 40 by 40, like I said, with 18-foot ceiling. So there's enough room to spread people around. It's a live drum kit. It's in the room. There is a little drum fort up. It's not a drum isolation booth because we still want that live feel in the room.
Sure.
It's like the way they used to make records. And we make records the old-fashioned way, just like they used to. I'm not behind glass. I'm in the room with the musicians themselves. And they always that's always a comment that I hear is, well, this is really a lot better than having you sit in a glass and talk to us. But the main thing is the quality of the microphones and the preamps. And of course, we have British EQ and all this stuff that's happening. Folks have seen YouTube videos of it. You see it, what's going on with it. But the two quotes is the comfortable seating and the space that they have, and then the ability to hear each other. That's the biggest thing, the leap from 95 or 96 or whatever up till we really started doing it in 2002, 2003 is when we really made a huge investment in the room.
And we should mention, well, actually not just mention, but be very clear that it is the members of the station that have made those improvements possible.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we could not have done it any other way. I mean, that's the only reason that the room has happened the way it has because, when we started producing Crowd Around the Mics, lots of them were going and, people were talking about them. And then as the quality improved, we were able to make that point. Well, you have made this possible. And all of a sudden, those Crowd Around the Mics became the most popular premium that we have now. And
absolutely.
We almost ran out of them last time. So we're going to have to order more this time, which is great. And we can't thank people enough for that. We always say it, and we can't say it enough. It's community. It's one big community. And the one thing that ties the whole community together is live music. Whether they're out at a venue in Greenville or Charlotte or Asheville or Knoxville or somewhere, it's live music. And we hear it time after time after time again is we love the live music that comes from Studio B.
Well, I want to play a quick game of Studio B flashcard.
Okie dokie. All right. I've been on the air for a while.
Because, I have the luxury of looking at a list of all the Studio B sessions that we have here. And so I see the sweep of everything that's been done. And I just want to throw some big names out to you that you have engineered these sessions for. And just tell me just quickly what you might remember about them. Dale McCurry.
Oh, my gosh. Just absolutely crazy. Crazy fun. That was the very first act that I ever interviewed actually on air. And we did it in the air studio.
Wow.
And Mark Keefe was programming director at the time. And it was Friday afternoon, 4:30, 5 o'clock, getting ready to go home. And he's like, oh, yeah, by the way, Del McCurry Band's coming by tomorrow. You need to interview him.
Thanks for the heads up.
Okie dokie. I can do that and engineer it at the same time. But, they've been here, I guess, three or four times now. And, now what they do when they come in, they know the room down there is set up just exactly like it will be for them on stage. And, they perform their show. Everything is so well organized. But truly professionally at what they do. I mean, there's a reason that they're the best of the best is, again, they're pros. They know what they're doing. But crazy fun. Crazy fun.
What about
nobody can say my name like Dale McCurry. Deanie.
The Dixie Hummingbirds with Ira Tucker.
Oh my gosh. Early one Sunday morning, I had been here doing the gospel truth and we got them in. It was the only time I guess it was available to do it. And they came in, and I was nervous. That was one of those times when I was really nervous because, you know, you get them in, and they sat down, you know, and they were just, you know, just as relaxed and just as plain as they could be. But, I mean, you know, here's someone I grew up listening to all my life, Ira Tucker. You know, we would listen to him out of WAGY in Gaffney, South Carolina. My grandfather, you know, listen to the gospel music station there, and I was like, the Dixie Hummingbirds. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, here they come. But a true gentleman and a craftsman, continuing along with a traditional sound, just like Dale. You know, he's keeping the thread alive. He's keeping it running. A great guy.
Yeah. Really. You know, I had the pleasure of doing that interview, and I got Ira to autograph an original 78 RPM of the Dixie Hummingbirds after that. One of my most treasured possessions. Okay. Jorma Kaukonen.
Whoa, wow, Jorma. You know, again, it was the first time he came here, I was nervous. I mean, I really was. I mean, you know, here's someone that I grew up listening to. I'm 12, 13 years old. I'm just literally playing my hands bloody trying to copy what he's doing on the guitar. You know, just a great guitar hero of mine. And I didn't know what to expect. I had no idea. You know, I had run into him a couple of times here and there, but it was always at a festival setting and never where it was one-on-one and very quiet. And, you know, the pre-production work, the emails and everything with it, it was like Jorma will be by himself. He'll have an acoustic guitar, and he needs a microphone, and microphones for his guitar. And, you know, it was just it. It was like he'll be there, you know, whatever the appointed time was. You know, he comes in, and, you know, we're sitting and we're talking, you know, we're talking about mutual friends that we know and folks that, and he had just had one of the big Fur Peace Ranch gatherings and all these people that we know. And, you know, he listened to the radio station as he was driving in, and he's a sweetheart. I mean, that's the only word you can just, that's really the only way to describe it. And we've become great friends now. You know, we talk all the time, you know, and here's someone who has such great respect for music. You know, he travels all over the world, and he realizes what a difference WNCW makes on the radio dial versus being in other parts of the country where there is nothing. He said you couldn't find a dozen radio stations that would play a Reverend Gary Davis song, much less one in the middle of the day. You know, he said, to him, that's just magic. That's gold. And he loves coming here. You know, still haven't got Jack and the Tuna Guys in, but he keeps telling me he's going to. You know, it's not up to him. It's a democratic process with Jack, and so maybe later on this summer we'll see.
Okay, well we'll hold that hope out. Gillian Welch.
The first time they were here, everybody was nervous. They weren't big stars yet. They were to us. They were to our listeners. We all knew who they were and how big it was. But it was before "O Brother, Where Art Thou?" And, you know, she hadn't won all these awards, and she hadn't got all this national recognition, so she was very shy. David did most of the interview that time.
Really?
He was the talker. He was, for what talking there was. But the music was just, it was incredible to watch them work up close. Now, the second time they were here was one of those Grand Ole Opry days. There were five live acts in the studio that day.
I remember that day.
Oh, it was just amazing. It was four. No, I think it might have been. It was four or five.
We were wall to wall that day.
It was a Grand Ole Opry day, but they had really done a lot of radio interviews, and they had really polished the act. And she was completely different than that shy young lady that we met the first time. She was so professional and. You might not think it, but a great sense of humor. Very funny, especially doing sound check. She was, you know, well, do I need to stand here? Well, how about if I stood over here? Well, how about if I stood over here? I'm like, no, you need to be in front of the microphones. Oh, okay, all right.
And here's one. I ran across this tape in preparation for future episodes of Studio B Rewind. Nickel Creek, and right when they were breaking big with Reasons Why and you know, just coming to a, you know, becoming famous. They played forever. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, sure, right, because they couldn't talk. Well, we were the first radio station they ever performed live on. We were the first radio station they ever did an interview with.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Well, they were so giddy, and they got so wound up that, you know, we broke. I don't know if you remember this. We broke for the news and came back and continued.
Right.
That was
a crazy day. Oh, Nelly. Yeah, it was like herding kittens comes to mind. Only I didn't have my kitten herding stick. I just kind of had to freehand them. You know, over here, boys. All right, here's a little shiny something. Look at this. But really, they were just absolutely just as green. That's back when Tracy Thomas was working with Sugar Hill Records. She set it up, and she told me, she said, they might be a handful, and she wasn't kidding. But you saw the musical genius. I mean, you just saw it there. You know, you saw what the potential was immediately. I had known Chris for a long time, though, since he was 13 or 14 years old when he was playing.
Chris Thielen?
Yeah, when he was playing straight up traditional, you know, he had released a couple of just straight up traditional bluegrass records where he played several of the instruments on them. And then the second one he had some help with. But, you know, I had met him and had talked with him before. And he had changed so much from then until where he was at when it was Nickel Creek. But that was my first time really getting to meet Sean and Sarah. And, you know, they have become great friends at the radio station. You know, they just love what we do. And anytime in their area, they call us up. We don't have to call them. They want to know, well, can we come in? Can we get in? Can we come in? You know, like when Chris brings the Punch Brothers in, you know, you're just like, well, it's herding cats again, but it's worth it. Oh,
they're very talented cats.
Oh my gosh, they're very talented cats. But then, you know, Sarah and Sean, you know, they're the same way. They come in and again, to have watched them grow from where there were yes, no, we played at a pizza parlor. Well, our mom and dad got us some instruments, to where they now are very articulate about their music and about the messages they have and what they do. It's pretty neat. But yeah, herding kittens.
Okay, one more. And this one is going to be in the inaugural edition of Studio B Rewind this Friday at 6. And that is the 1998 session with Emmylou Harris and Spy Boy.
Oh, my. You know, here's one. I had known Emmy for a while, and, you know, I had seen her around Nashville, and we had, you know, run across each other on the roads and all. But still, I was nervous, but everybody was nervous. I mean, you know, everybody. Marshall Ballou is the one that did the interview.
Morning host.
We called it Crossroads in those days.
Yes,
it was
we did.
The Crossroads host. And I think, you know, that may be the most nervous I think I've ever seen him. I'm going to say it maybe have been that way. But again, you know, such a gracious lady. And one of those professionals I was talking about earlier on, whatever the situation was, she's readily adaptable to it and will still put on a great show and still turn in a great interview. And she can talk. She has the ability to communicate what's going on with her. But, I mean, you know, she's been around for a while, so she understands what's happening with it. But, yeah, that was a nervous day. That was a little antsy.
I can imagine, but it sounds great, and Marshall did a great job, and just overall it's just a great session and a great way to kick off the show. Now, as one final question, I know that Studio WNCW just got a grant for some improvements in Studio B.
Yes, we did.
Okay, so what's next?
As far as what we're doing with the grant money?
Yeah.
And
in general.
The couple of major expenses that we are covering are putting up new drapes. They've been here since 1988, so they're quite faded. They're torn.
Yeah.
Some of the rigging is not quite up to code the way it should be, so we're doing upgrades there on that. We also have been able to do several replacements of some parts that I've had, some pieces of gear that I've had that, you know, really needed to be replaced, you know, a couple of years ago or something, whatever. And so we're able to do that. Plus, I was able to get some spares, able to work on that. We are upgrading the drum kit, the house kit that the drummers are always down there. We have a house kit,
which is huge. You know, yeah. It's one thing we used to not have, and that was a big stumbling block.
Oh, yeah, sure, right. Yeah, artists didn't want to unload the truck. That's the reason that artists come by here now is, I mean, I literally have everything you need. I have drum kits. I have amplifiers, guitar amplifiers. If the amplifiers I have don't fit their needs, I can readily get them from Stan Thomas over at B-Sharp Music here in Spindale. You know, I call him up and go, well, you know, so-and-so needs this, and I can get them right away. But most of the time, the amps that we have, there's no problems with them. We have that. But upgrading the drum kit, furniture, I had a piece of furniture in there that was from the 1970s.
Put it on eBay.
Now, I loved it.
And I thought, well, I love my little futon. They're wanting to get a new.
You're talking about that little two-seater thing?
Yeah, they were pressuring me to get a new futon. Well, I'm glad they did. It's beautiful, and we upgraded that. Also have new rugs. We've done new rugs in several different places. Have a beautiful new rug that's coming for the drums. We're going to put underneath the drums. Oh, gosh, what else do we do? New gobos. We have different sound absorption panels and things that we place around, between certain instruments and things to keep loud drums from bleeding into microphones and stuff like that. We did that. I don't have the list with me right now, but it's been a major upgrade. The grant really came in handy, and it's been really, really nice. And that has also been matched along with our great friends who sponsor the Studio B sessions, Sierra Nevada Brewery. You know, these folks came in and they immediately saw, okay, here's what we want to sponsor right here, because we're all about the live music, and they do that. And so that's, that's been part of what they've done is they've helped out and done the same thing there. Again, community. It's all one big family. And again, you draw that same line right back to what? Live music.
Yeah, live music and what takes place in Studio B and what has taken place there is the absolute heart of WNCW. And I think it comes through in Studio B Rewind, the new show that is premiering this Friday at 6. And Dennis, all I can tell you is, as I've listened to these sessions, my estimation of you has grown.
Get over that.
Yeah, with everyone. But I'm also just amazed at the artists that come through here. So
it's amazing. I mean, you look at the list of people who have come through here. You named off some, but you got John Mayer. Here's John Mayer.
That's right.
Came here twice. Once before anybody knew who he was.
I did that interview.
It was before his Body's a Wonderland. It was before that song broke.
No Such Thing was the album.
No Such Thing. That's right. Such Thing was the album that was on. And then we get all these newer acts that come through who all of a sudden just blow up, like Carl Denson, Trombone Shorty. The very first Warren Haynes pre-Christmas jam happened here in Studio B, the very first one. Susan Tedeschi, Derek Trucks met in Studio B. I often go over and point to the spot where she was like, I want you to look at there. But it was that same. But it was that. It was Warren, Susan, and Derek, and Little Milton.
And I remember
an amazing session. And, I guess it was three. We did three of them here. And so finally it became so large, everybody was wanting to come and play. Everybody's wanting to come play. Well, we couldn't do it here anymore. We had to move it out to a different venue. Look at folks like an afternoon that we came in. It was the Mac Arnold. They were doing a Mac Arnold video shoot. South Carolina Public Television was doing this documentary on the great Mac Arnold, who played with Muddy Waters all these years. So Mac had called up these musicians who had played with Muddy: Kim Wilson, Willie Big Eyes Smith, Steady Rollin' Bob Margolin. And so here I am. Again, I'm nervous. I've known Mac. I've met him. We've talked before, and he's been in the studio several times. But, they came in that day and we're doing a sound check. They're getting some levels and they're playing, they run through a couple of songs and they ran through another song. And I was just hypnotized by it. I was like, oh my gosh, listen to these guys. So, they play this wonderful session. It's an incredible interview. There's five or six cameras rolling in there and, I'm nervous. We get through. And, so I said, well, where have you guys been rehearsing at? And Matt looked over at Willie and said, I ain't seen Willie in 30 years. And Kim looked at Steady Rolling Bob Margolin and said, I ain't seen him in 25 years. Willie said, I ain't seen Kim in 40 years.
Holy cow.
I said, what? He said, yeah. I said, y'all haven't rehearsed? He's like, no, we just played the songs today. I was like, well, I'm glad you waited until it was over. But it's those moments like that, and it happens all the time. And, we're talking about all these national acts. But then you got to go back and look at all the regional acts and the local acts that come through. I mean, my gosh, you think about, all of these great musicians, Balsam Range, even though these guys were all
some of them Grammy Award winners, Dove Award winners. They had pretty much retired from the road. Now you're going to put together a band. They're going to play a little on the weekends. So they come down there and play, and the next thing you know, they're blowing up. They're winning every IBMA award that could happen. You know, you got folks that come through, Tyler Ramsey. Here's a great example of a young, just gifted gentleman from Asheville, North Carolina, who came in and we all fell in love with him. He's good looking. He's tall. He's a great songwriter.
And he's sweet.
And what happens? He becomes a member of the Band of Horses. You know, he's this big, huge national touring act now. And I think of all the things that really happens is being able to do that, to be able to give these local and regional artists a place to play on the same field.
Amen.
That these other tremendous, like Yorma, like John Mayer, like Emmylou Harris, you know, you give them the same playing field and you put them in, and 9 times out of 10, they'll turn in just as strong a performance.
That's a great point, because there are no corners cut when it's somebody from around here. It's you set up, the prep is exactly the same.
Oh, sure. We want everybody to be comfortable. Yeah, that's the main thing, is to get the comfort out of them and to make it happen.
Well, you as the listener to WNCW and as the member of WNCW make what happens in Studio B possible. And you're going to hear the fruits of your labor as part of Studio B Rewind Friday nights at 6. And you're going to hear it continuing into the future with the coming performances in Studio B. And Dennis, thank you. This has been so much fun. We got to do this again.
Maybe not.